Welcome to the Time and Motion podcast with me, your host, Lee Stevens. For over 25 years, I've worked with businesses all over the world to improve the technology and the people within them. In this podcast, I share some of my experiences and I chat to guests who generously share their stories of how to, or in some cases, how not to, live a productive life. I hope you enjoy the show. Ruth McLeod, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Lee. I'm very excited to be here.
And you are in the sunny US of A.
I am. I'm based in the Greater Bay Area in San Francisco. I've been here since July 2020. And for those following along, it wasn't the greatest of times to be moving to the States.
Doesn't sound like it was. Okay, so before we get going, who are you? What do you do? And how do you end up in US of A when you've got a strong Kiwi accent?
That's strong. As I said, Ruth McLeod, I'm the Trade Commissioner for New Zealand Trade and Enterprise based in San Francisco. So for those of you who haven't heard of New Zealand Trade and Enterprise, it's the government's economic development agency, and our job is to help Kiwi companies grow bigger, better, faster for the good of New Zealand. Part two of your question, how did I come to be here? I've worked at NZT since the dawn of time. I have a standard joke, which is, if anyone's watched Jurassic Park, you know, with that scene with the Jeep and the doors and Sam Neill, if you look really, really closely, you'll find me. You won't. I've said that joke before and people mistook me for actually being in the movie. I wasn't, but it was just to illustrate that I've been at NZT since 2003. So I started with them in New York, spent 5 years in New York, then back to New Zealand. We'd had a son by that stage, so I wanted him to be around whānau. And then this opportunity came up and, yeah, we jumped at it. We didn't know that there was going to be a pandemic because we didn't have a crystal ball. But, hey, that was 3 years ago. So here we are.
Fantastic. And before that, early life, what was early life like for you? Where did you grow up? You know, what did you do? Where was that?
Sure. Well, I grew up in Auckland, Tamaki Makaurau, and I was one of six children. How personal do we get, Lee, on this podcast? Because I can, you know.
As personal as you want to get, Ruth. Personal as you want to get.
Okay, excellent. So I was one of six children. Had a great upbringing, but it was marred by the fact that my father died when I was four, and my mother raised six children under the age of 20. So, yeah, that was tough for her. But my hat's off to her. She's since passed away at the ripe old age of 87. But growing up without a dad was pretty tough.
I'd imagine it was. And which part of Auckland?
Papakura.
And then, so education. So what did education consist of for you?
Yeah, my mother was big on education. She, actually my entire family bar me grew up in Scotland, so I'm a first gen Kiwi. She was big on education. Her family couldn't afford to send her to medical school, so she became a nurse instead. So that was very much drummed into us. And I had the good fortune of going to St. Cuthbert's College in Auckland from the age of 11. So that was a really great grounding in before girl power was a thing. It was girl power.
Okay. First job?
First job was at Xerox photocopying when I was about 15. But at university, I did work for a chicken company. And this was before automation. And I had a summer job on the deboning line. So in a freezer for 3 months cutting up chickens.
Okay. And then decided that wasn't the life for you?
That wasn't the life for me. I was doing a BA BCom at university. So that took me 5 years rather than four because when I started, I thought I wanted to be a lawyer. But then I took calculus and so failed pre-law and was very bitter in my second year. And so the whole BA BCom, which was in political science management, took 5 years. So after university, my generation, Gen X, we were the first generation in New Zealand to have fees associated with university. So while many of my predecessors would, you know, jump in a combi and go and work in a pub, we graduated with student loan debt, a lot of us. So quickly, we were really focused on getting work. I tried to get some work in New Zealand. That didn't pan out. I met my now husband. We moved to Melbourne. I was in Melbourne for 5 years, had various roles at Telstra, had quite an interesting role at Telstra.com when they thought they were going to be online everything. Then I moved to Munich because my husband got a job opportunity. Landed in Munich in 2002. And for the historians, that's not a good time to land in Munich when you don't speak German. So I couldn't get a job in my field, which at that point was project management and IT, really. So I ended up completely unqualified teaching English to executives. And my lesson plans were written for me, but my first lesson was with a group of execs from Deutsche Bank. I knew I was in trouble when I walked into the lesson and they were reading the Wall Street Journal. I thought, I'm cooked. But I had a lot of fun doing that. Should I keep going? I feel like I'm on a roll here.
Very good. Carry on. Yeah.
So, after Germany, again, there's a reoccurring pattern. My husband got posted to New York and he said, do you want to go? And I said, if they speak English, please. And moved to New York. Took a long time to get a job there, actually. Again, 2003, New York was still very muted after 9/11. But this is where I found my way into NZT, starting off kind of an events consular role. And then my kind of NZT stint started.
And like a lot of Kiwi couples, a lot of couples around the world, obviously you're a team, right? And you share responsibilities with parenting and earning and socializing, etc. So, you know, for him doing his role, you know, that was probably like a lot of us do, right? We go, actually, as part of Team Stevens or, you know, Team McLeod or whatever that might be, the team. And you help each other out and you find your way. So, but that's quite a common thing, right? You know, especially in the, you know, I think since 2000, actually, you know, people are more inclined to go around the world and people say, oh, you're following your partner, but you're not. You're doing it as a family. You're learning new experiences. And it sounds like that was the case for you guys.
Yeah, that was. And it wasn't always easy. And I, you know, in diplomatic circles, they call it the trailing spouse, which is a terrible term. But I think for me, you know, some of the decisions we made were squarely for my husband's career. And that was tough because it did put me in the back seat. But what I recognized is that if, you know, from a relationship point of view, I can't hold a grudge because I said, yes, let's do it. So I can't hold a grudge. That's just not helpful for our relationship. But, you know, 21-year-old me might second guess some of those decisions, to be brutally honest.
Yeah. Okay. So you're in New York and that's when you first got involved with NZTE?
Yeah, that's right.
So how did that come about?
Look, it was the old fashioned way, Lee. I didn't know anyone, but I just applied and they had quite a rigorous, well, maybe not that rigorous, so I got in, as they say, but quite a like involved recruitment process and worked there for nearly 4 years in New York. Had my son, so he's got a US passport, was born in Jersey, so he's a Jersey boy. And as I said, 2008 came along, we decided to go back to New Zealand. Our son was 18 months old. We wanted him to grow up around whānau.
And do you think there's been kind of way over the last, say, 20, 25 years, from my understanding, there's been waves where Kiwis go off and, you know, for different reasons, but generally whether it's financial, whether it's down to the economy, but there's these waves. But we're seeing it a little bit at the moment, right, you know, where Kiwis are going off and going over to Australia and America and England, etc. But that's just, for me, that's just like the people I speak to and the friends I've got. That's just part of the DNA. That's part of the Kiwi culture, right? So do you think that's kind of ingrained into you as well, where you kind of knew that you wanted to go travel and see the world and, you know, you're part of those Kiwis that go exploring?
I think so. But, you know, as I mentioned before, I think the bigger difference is, and anyone who's pre-Gen X can correct me on this, but I think the biggest difference is, whereas pre-student loans, and I'll put pre-student loans and post-student loans. So pre-student loans, I feel like people were of that explorer mindset and they wanted to go overseas and get in the combi van and do the contiki, and they may or may not fall into careers when they're doing that. I think post-student loan, people were focused. I myself had a $20,000 loan, which was relatively reasonable back in the 90s. But I think that's what's changed for me, Lee, is that people come out with a student loan. They think, well, maybe I'll get some scars, a couple of years in New Zealand, then I'll go offshore. And I think a lot of it is actually to do with, heck, how am I going to pay this student loan back? Yes, we're still explorers, but I think it's also very pragmatic. How do I get rid of this loan fast?
Yeah. Okay. So NZTE 2003. What was the purpose of that organization then and what is it now?
Yeah, it's always been the same. I think NZTE again, any fact checkers there who want to correct me. I think we came into being in 2001. There were two different agencies at the time, one focused on domestic capability building, one focused on helping companies export. They came together as New Zealand Trade and Enterprise. We were always about helping companies grow internationally. I think what we saw with Pete Crisp, who's still the CEO now, he came in with a very clear purpose, and he spent a lot of time making sure everybody understood that our purpose was really to grow companies, as I said, bigger, better, faster for the good of New Zealand. So our orientation, what we talk about, how we work, is squarely thinking about that New Zealand company and how we can wrap around and support them. Because let's face it, anyone who's going offshore, you have to be gutsy, maybe a little bit crazy. You have to be certainly gutsy to take on, if I think about the US, the world's most competitive market, right? So our job is to really help companies navigate that and really put them in touch with others that have done before them and put them in touch with smart people that can guide them. That's what we're there to do.
We'll talk about tech in a moment, but
yeah.
If I go think about, you know, 20 years ago, I'm guessing that what was being exported was probably a little bit different as well. And so I'm guessing the usual suspects like, you know, dairy and, you know, all of the
wine,
the wine and the green stuff we grow right here in New Zealand would have been probably the focus. So is that the case? And, you know, and how has that changed, you know, over the last 20 years?
Yeah, I mean, it's changed dramatically, and really probably in the last 5 to 7 years, we've seen it accelerate. So tech is now the second largest export earner for New Zealand, which is phenomenal. And the other kind of factoid I love about tech is that Auckland is now home per capita to the most game developers in the world. So, and what we're seeing now, and what I'm certainly seeing, is repeat, well, they're not repeat offenders, I'll call them that, but I think they are the other term is serial entrepreneurs. So we're seeing people who may have sold out in 2006, 7, and they're now on advisory boards, they're directors, they're reinvesting. So I think that's the big change for me, that people with experience are coming back into the ecosystem, giving back to the ecosystem, and also investing and growing new businesses. And that's, you know, that's starting to really build momentum in tech in particular.
What do you think the perception of Kiwi businesses is in the US?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it depends on what sector you're referring to, but I'm going to talk to tech, which I know a bit better than the others. That's where my team's focus is. Look, I think the US broadly doesn't really care about the origin story when it comes to tech, except that New Zealand has a very good reputation for being honest, straightforward, easy to deal with. So that's a real plus. But when it comes down to it, that might get your foot in the door. But then, of course, like any business decision, does it make sense? What's the ROI? What's the integration pathway? All those things. But I think on the whole, New Zealanders, I had somebody say to me years ago, and I think this is a really clever way to think about it. He said that New Zealanders are the O-type blood of business. They're accepted everywhere. And I think that's absolutely true for the US. And people are intrigued by New Zealand. If I had a dollar for every time someone said it's on my bucket list, which is a great thing, right? We are on someone's bucket list. It's a very good start.
Okay. So you mentioned tech's your focus. And is that was that just a natural thing that evolved? Because, you know, as we export here from New Zealand, it's easy to do that. And obviously it's digital, et cetera. But yeah, you mentioned it's number two. Number one is still primary industry, I'm guessing. Still dairy, right? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Dairy, yeah.
So with the kind of shift towards tech and the focus, how have NZTE had to change, and how have as an organization, you know, what have you had to start thinking about?
Yeah, I think the key thing is we've really had to think about our talent and how we specifically support tech companies, right? Because there's a business model and there's a pattern, there's a vernacular that is, you know, typical of tech. So we've had to think about who we recruit so that they can come alongside businesses. We've also had to think about some of our programs and developing them specifically for tech. Previous to coming to the States, I ran the International Beachheads program. So we recognized a number of years ago that our bench strength of advisors wasn't strong enough in tech. So how do we bring more tech smarts around the table, really? So the orientation, you know, has been, okay, what do we need to support these companies? What's the talent? What are the programs? Who are the people we need to attract? The programs that are more one-to-one oriented.
And how do businesses engage, Ruth? Because obviously if you're an early stage startup or even at the idea stage or you're thinking about a startup and a tech startup for that matter, what's the best way for a business to engage with NZTE?
Yeah, literally it is to call our 0800 number, which I don't have off the top of my head. It's literally that. And I think the thing, Lee, though, is that, you know, we aren't necessarily always the right answer depending on where your business is at. So if you're, you know, if you're really incubation stage, that might be better. You might be better served by Callahan or business.gov. But our customer advisory team who'll answer that call or answer your email are in a position to direct you to where it's most suitable for you at the time.
Okay. So let's talk about some of the success stories in the US in the tech sector. Who, in your opinion, have they been?
Yeah, I think Parkable comes to mind. I mean, there are a lot. I'm not picking favorites, but Parkable's top of mind, Lee, because we saw the team last week. I think what they've done really, really well is when they came to the US, they came with a loose hypothesis about what it might take to succeed here, but they weren't fixed on it. So they, 3 or 4 years ago, they came to us and said, we think we're applying our B2C model, as people would know it in New Zealand. We think that's the space for us to play. Can you help us decide if that is in fact the space to play? They went through a program that we offer through UCLA Gap, got a whole bunch of research done, and it was clear that the B2C space was already really crowded here, and that caused them to pivot towards B2B where they are today. And I think cut to 4 years later, with a lot of blood, sweat, and toil from Toby and Brody and the team, they've now won global contracts with Meta. They're in discussions with other very large tech companies, University of Cambridge, banks in Australia and New Zealand, and they're going about their growth really thoughtfully, bringing on excellent people who are all, and I guess, you know, this is something I see in Parkable, who've all got this spirit and entrepreneur outlook that just pervades that culture. So I'm really bullish on Parkable. It's a hard space. They're in the commercial property space. So anyone following along in the US, particularly in San Francisco, that's a hard market to be in, but they've got a compelling proposition. Yeah, draw to blank.
Okay, right. Okay. So what would you say some of the common mistakes that Kiwi businesses and Aussie businesses for that matter make when they're trying to tackle the US or trying to get some sort of traction over there?
Yeah, I think it's similar to, you know, the Parkable story, but I think what people might underestimate is the need for focus over here. So you might have a template in Australia and New Zealand that works really well. You're across multiple industries and that works. And you do that for very good reasons, because the size of either market is not big enough to sustain a laser focus. When you come to the US, that doesn't work as well because the market is just so much bigger. So if I think about the term niche, I think it means something quite different in New Zealand than it does in the US. So niche to me means small, means maybe a small total addressable market. It means you're not going to make a lot of money. But niche over here just means focus. So the example I always give is one of Pushpay. So Pushpay, New Zealand church management and payment software company, sold this year to a private equity firm in Melbourne for $1.6 billion. And they were focused solely on a niche in the US, but that niche was churches. And if they focused on a niche in New Zealand, their TAM would be 4,000. But their TAM in the US is 400,000. So they, through a lot of trial and error, landed on the church niche and said, we're going to put all our wood behind just churches. And when I say just churches, it's 400,000 of them. So back to your question, I think there's a lot to be kind of gleaned from that, which is they pointed everything, who they hired, their brand, their marketing, their pitching, to a specific ICP and really nailed that. But what I see is companies coming with that New Zealand Australian template of multiple industries and saying, I'm just going to plop that down. So I was talking to a company recently and they've got fantastic technology and they've said we want to tackle defense, utilities, and the hospital system. And I just said, no, you're not. I was a bit blunt because unless you've got unlimited marketing budget, unless you've got unlimited product development resources, that's a really really impossible task. So maybe start with utilities and maybe just narrow it down to, is it one utility? Is it Texas, utilities in Texas, and build and use that as your beachhead and then build and grow?
Yeah. I think some of the other mistakes I sense talking to founders as well, especially over here in New Zealand, is when they tackle the US, they don't appreciate the scale and the size. So, you know, some of the best bits of advice I've been given is pick a state maybe to start off with, you know, and just because that's like that one state's probably still, you know, 20 times bigger than New Zealand, you know, so if not more. So I think that's probably some common issue. Another question I was going to ask you was around product market fit and validation. So it still amazes me how many businesses kind of skip that stage, and we might have been one of those businesses, but that's a different conversation. but how is that the case? And you know, what can businesses do to make sure they do good validation and they kind of start making that journey towards product market fit?
Yeah, I think that the key is getting here and you know, finding those initial people that will have conversations with you. But I think it's a mindset thing. I interviewed somebody last year and he had some really good advice. He said, don't think of year one as revenue in the US. If you set your sights on the US, don't think year one, I'm going to get revenue. Think year one's going to be a learning year. So if you can get here or remotely, you know, find people on LinkedIn who you think are your ideal customer, reach out to them, find out who you know that knows that person, reach out, have a conversation. You're not selling at that point. And for that first year, sounds like a luxury, it'll pay back in spades. If that first year you can really do that from afar, or better still here, you're in a much better position to understand if that product market fit is realistic. And really importantly, how should you be showing up in market? What should you be saying? What are the hot buttons? All that good stuff.
So for people thinking, that sounds great, I'm on the next plane out to San Francisco. How practical is that though, Ruth?
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily be, that wouldn't be the first thing I'd do. The first thing I'd do is get on LinkedIn. If you're not a LinkedIn user, now's the time to really start. What's your brand look like on LinkedIn? What's your personal brand? And people are amazingly receptive. And the good thing about Kiwis, and we've got a phone company that attests to this, you know, 2 degrees. You'll find there are a million Kiwi passport holders internationally, a million outside of New Zealand. So you're most likely to find a Kiwi somewhere that knows somebody and can make that warm introduction for you. And one of the shout outs I'll give actually is to Kia New Zealand. If you don't know Kia, check out their website. That is the purpose of Kia, is to connect Kiwis with other Kiwis offshore. And they've got this fantastic matching service or connection service that actually you can do that. I want to know about X. Who knows about X? Can you connect me? So the LinkedIn, Kia, friends and family, colleagues, peers, you'll be amazed when you say, I need to find out about this. Who can help me? How many people will actually help you so that you don't have to buy a ticket just yet?
Okay, so next question. So one of the big hot topics last week at SASDA, which is the Global SaaS Conference, was around money. And, you know, a year ago, it was starting to slow down. There was less money around for investing. And I think the key takeaway I took was that there's a slight recovery now, and maybe there's slightly more money than it was a year ago or at the start of 2023. So how would you summarize the VC and kind of the investment market for Kiwis thinking, you know, they might want to raise some money over in the States at the moment?
Look, this is not my area of expertise. I won't get over my skis, but what I will say is that, you know, New Zealand companies have never attracted crazy multiples of valuations. So I think now is the time, if you've got a compelling proposition, and a shout out to Michael Siebel. If anybody's on LinkedIn, track down Michael Siebel, managing partner Y Combinator, who gives a brilliant talk on what to include in your pitch. But I think now is the time, because Kiwi companies are, you know, maybe to their detriment, they're realistic, pragmatic, honest, straightforward. This is what we're hearing the VC community wants. They don't want jazz hands. They don't want ridiculous projections that may or may not come true. So I think if you're looking to raise cash, now's a really good time.
Yeah, and I think my takeaway from that was, no matter what environment or what economic timeline you're in, that there's always money for a good idea, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And that was easily the best talk. I'll put the link in the show notes, but yeah, go and see his, for anyone looking to raise money, or even if you're not looking to raise money, if you're doing a startup, for me, that this should be the template for how you need to run your business in a lot of ways, right?
Yeah, he was fantastic.
Okay, so let's go back to NZTE. So what are some of the other ways that you're helping Kiwi businesses over there?
Yeah, probably. I mean, there's lots of different ways. So if you think about a business, you know, setting up in a new market, so right from what structure do I need? What are the tax implications of setting up over here? Who do I hire? How do I hire? What do I have to be thinking about when I hire? So everything that you think about running a business that you might have set up in New Zealand, we can support you with that through our own advisory network or referrals out to other providers who are experts. I mean, US tax, goodness me, no one tries to be an expert in that. So those are kind of the fundamental sort of operational things. But also I think one of the jewels in our crown is the Beachheads Advisory Network. And, you know, one of my achievements was working on that for a number of years and love them to pieces, all the advisors equally. Some are definitely more favorite than others. But the Beachheads Advisor Network is a group of individuals who, in this case, based in the US, who've got great US experience, who can navigate all the things I mentioned, but also really get the on-the-ground perspective about things like pricing and product market fit and marketing and what's my digital footprint need to look like. So again, anything to do with your growing your business as you thought about as an entrepreneur in New Zealand, we can support with aspects of that through our networks and through our team.
Okay. Is there any particular areas you feel that are underutilized and maybe should be leveraged better by businesses?
I think for me, and you know, shout out to the Kiwi SaaS community. I think that the biggest thing that if I was an entrepreneur, and I never have been, and I'm acutely aware of it, but I think what I would be doing, based on what I know now, is I'd be reaching out to my peers, like all the time, obnoxiously so. So in terms of underutilized, NZT does make these connections between companies, but I think that, you know, if we all had that mindset, and I'm just going to take a little segue here, if you just bear with. When I went back to New Zealand for the first time after being in New York, people would say, what's the difference between a Kiwi founder and a US founder? And I'd say, well, my observation is that the US founder, you might incubate something in his garage, quote unquote, but really quickly, he or she will say, who's smarter than me? Who's done it before? Who can I bring into my circle so that this idea gets legs, either flames or just flies, right? I think we're getting better at this in New Zealand, but I think our tendency is to incubate a bit too long, to stay in the metaphorical garage a bit too long. So I think the big unlock would be if we all had that mindset of who's smarter than me, who's done it before, who can I talk to? Because I know you'd have had this experience. When you ask that question, Lee, of others, people will go, sure, I'll help. I'll give you half an hour. Then you should speak to Sharon or Bob. They'll also give you half an hour. Before you know it, you've got a whole group of people who are invested in your success.
Yeah, and I think that was for me when we talked about difference between Aussies and Kiwis. But I think, you know, the similarities is this, it's like, you know, it's just, it's so, so similar in their mindset as well. And I think you're absolutely right. The amount of people that you reach out to, and a lot of very humble, good humans, I think is the most overused term I've seen for the last, on everyone's LinkedIn post the last couple of days. But it's probably very apt, right? You know, people were just very nice people. And, you know, I'm pretty certain that, you know, regardless of what happens, we've worked full Surrey and, you know, and even if going to Brisbane and people stop talking to me for that for a little while, but there'd be people you'd be able to pick up the phone to or drop an email to go, look, I need some help in this, or, you know, I've been thinking about this, why? And, you know, I think that you'd get that help, but I don't think you would get that in the UK. I don't think you get that in the US, if I'm being completely honest. I think that was quite obvious that the scale that people play at, if, you know, they kind of, I don't think it's intentional, but, you know, the reality is you're playing at a different level, right? So, you know, if you're a $300 million business, you know, $300 million of ARR, you're not going to have much in common with a $10 million ARR business that's from Australia or New Zealand. So, but I don't, but I think the people is what it boils down to a lot of the time, right?
Yeah. And I think that the asking for input, help, whatever you want to say. I think if you're vulnerable enough, again, an overused word, I'm sorry about that. But if you need to ask, because people will, in the Kiwi context, give you the time of day.
Yeah. And I think you mentioned Kiwi SaaS. A big shout out to Brett and Kim and all those guys and girls kind of you know, running those events and really driving awareness about, you know, SaaS and especially that they're creating that community. And yeah, one of the ideas I talked about with Brett was last week was actually you could actually plot this out, you know, from a cycle, from a, okay, I've got this idea through to validation, through to maybe raising some money through Series A, Series B. It's essentially it's that SaaS napkin, right? But there's a bit before it. And I said to him, there we go, that's your life cycle. And if you can explain that to people, because I think a lot of startups and a lot of tech startups, we spoke about this last week, they get so much bad advice from people that have never, you know, have never gone on and taken on the world. They've never given it a crack. And my joke, these are my words, no one else's, is that I used to get really frustrated with the grey hair, grey suit, grey mentality of some of these advisors that were knocking around as professional advisors. And so that's not a dig at any of those in particular, but it was just, when you speak to an advisor, you want someone who's been there and got the t-shirt, right? Or at least had a crack at it, and you want to learn from their failings. And I guess that's some of those people that haven't done that and are gift dishing out advice very loosely, in my opinion. You know, this is very much my opinion. I don't think they're in a position to be able to give that advice. But, you know, I think with people like KiwiSaaS and NZTE and, you know, all that good work that you can see that you guys are doing, I think, you know, businesses are going to be far better position than maybe they were 5-10 years ago to get that advice. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really interesting you should say that, because I was involved with Beachheads for a number of years, and we went through iterations of that model, and it was originally a Dragon's Den kind of model.
Yeah.
Advisors would pepper the founder with questions and generally make them feel fairly inadequate and beaten up. And we realized, guess what? That's not actually helping anybody. So we switched from an advisory, here's what you should do model, to much more getting alongside coaching model. You know, because as you and I talked about last week, Lee, you know, if someone's giving you advice and they can't hope, unless they're, you know, living next to you and breathing next to you, they can't hope to know what you know about your business and the context of your business. It's really impossible. What they can be really good at, what I think our Beachheads advisors are really good at, are asking questions to help you think through your own business. So, you know, that was a really important pivot for Beachheads, and it paid dividends, because people felt like advisors were getting alongside them. In fact, we toyed with changing the name, because they're not really advisors. They're sort of coaches and question askers, but coach doesn't seem right either.
Yeah. And I think the other thing as well is that, and once again, this is just my experience of coaching in as a whole, people think that coaches and advisors are going to give you all the answers. And I think the reality is they're not. The answers are going to come from within, but what they're going to do is ask the right questions that, you know, they're going to be curious, and they're going to get you to come up with the answer. Because, you know, people say, right, okay, how do you make my business 100 million? It's not going to work like that, right? You know, so
no.
Yeah.
Okay. No, there's no silver bullet. And I think sometimes we do have businesses coming to us with, you know, asking a specific question, and they might get a bit frustrated because we're like, well, maybe that's not the question to ask. Maybe the question's actually over here, but they really want the silver bullet.
So we mentioned about that, maybe that more of a local mindset, you know, and not, you know, realize there's a big world out there and validating, as you say, from afar, et cetera. Is there any other kind of common themes or common mistakes that you see businesses that maybe about to make that you catch, or that you see happen, you know, happen quite a bit? You know, what, so for anyone listening to this, who's getting a masterclass in not what to do, you know, what are some of the things that other businesses, you know, when they're looking to expand into the US do?
We'll just call it a class, hey? let anyone decide if it's a masterclass. But I think the other thing that I see is that you've had some success in New Zealand and Australia, right? So you're feeling pretty buoyant, bullish, and you're going to take on the US. I think the mindset I see, which isn't as successful, is we're in scale-up mode. In fact, the mindset you need to be successful is we're an educated startup in the US. So I think if you sort of go back to that concept of a little bit scrappy, no one kind of knows us, How do I think about growth in the US as I thought about growth when I first started my business? I think if you think with that mentality, that's a pretty big unlock as well. And I think where that really gets awkward, shall we say, if you think you're in scale-up mode, you might then try and hire salespeople in, you know, thinking you're in scale-up mode. But the skill set you need is a salesperson or team that's really a startup sales team. So I think that's where it can get. That's where you see it actually falling apart. And I think if you talk to a number of tech companies that have set up here, they've made the wrong initial hires, thinking they needed a, you know, mature account executive. they didn't. They kind of need a BD or a really technical salesperson. So I think that's something to
do. You think that's also because this is kind of a common thing as well, is that a lot of businesses struggle to take it beyond founder sales. So, you know, in the early days, it's your business, it's your baby, you know, every single, you know, bit of that business inside out, you know, the benefits, you know how to sell. But the minute you try and scale up, you obviously need systems and processes in place, right? And it needs to be not you selling. And and we see that quite a bit in any business for that matter, you know, that actually once you take it beyond the founder. And look, I was definitely guilty of that as well in a services business, you know, some time ago. Yeah. But actually what you have to do is you have to sort of go, okay, well, how can we systemize this? And how can we, you know, create a system and a process that's going to sell the benefits rather than go and look how great our product is or our services, right?
100%. And I think that's, again, it's changing, but I think we under invest in sales ops, sales process in New Zealand. And I can think of a company that we used to run a sales service for that very reason in NZTE, a company called Autex. I'm pretty okay with talking about them, I think. They really knew that they weren't optimizing their sales teams. And the gap for them was they didn't have a sales playbook. So they didn't have anything documented. So that meant such a cascading impact, right? So you onboard a new salesperson. How do you train them? Where's the book? You didn't have one. So you're absolutely right, Lee. I think, you know, moving through that growth stage, and you're maybe on at this point, you're onboarding Americans as well. So there's a whole culture thing to get across. There's a whole values and what the business stands for. So that onboarding is really important. But then here's a playbook of how you sell in XYZ company. If that doesn't exist, do not hire anybody.
Yeah. And I think those same rules apply for consulting businesses as well, that you should have a playbook for your consultants. You should have a playbook for your sales guys, your account managers. Yeah. You know, it shouldn't be any part of your business that hasn't been, you know, articulated to say, because otherwise there's no consistency, right? And how do you know if you're, because Jason Lenkin talks to us about this quite a lot, is that he will often take on two salespeople at the same time.
Yeah, that's right.
Because, you know, if they both fail, then it's on you. If one of them fails, then maybe it's them, you know. But, you know, I think that's, you can apply that methodology and that playbook, you know, to a whole heap of businesses, especially New Zealand. And the other big thing, I guess, once again, my opinion, not anyone else's, is that there's still very much that kind of old school sales mentality in New Zealand, right? So if anyone tries to sell you something, there's a good chance they're going to be wearing a blue suit, a white shirt, brown tan shoes, and with a bit of chest hair showing, right? And so, yes, that would have been me a few years ago. But once again, unfortunately, that typical salesperson, you still see them at the conferences and you still see them, you know, at certain meetings. And unfortunately, when they turn up like that, there's, you know, straight away you're thinking, no, there's not really much consistency here. But
I think what did I read today on LinkedIn? Somebody that this is not theirs. I've seen it before. If you're selling, you've already lost. If you're trying to convince somebody, you've already lost. Going back to that sales process, sales ops kind of concept, I think also that there are lots of good, you know, consultancies and advisors, dare I say it, out there that can help you with that. I think people look at that kind of challenge and go, well, I don't have one of these. That sounds quite tough, out of my area of expertise or whatever. It's actually not. It's really, really practical once you get a framework together. It's just about drawing out from the founder, perhaps in your case, Lee, drawing out from you how you do it.
Yep.
Codifying it and then building. It's not that difficult. And if anybody tells you it is, they're overselling you.
Yeah, 100%. Okay. We mentioned about San Francisco and the Valley being, you know, where businesses use the go-to place. And certainly for tech businesses, it's kind of, I get it. The talent pool's there, the investors are there. You know, if people say you got to be in the Bay. But from what I've seen over the last sort of 2 or 3 years, there's definitely a trend of businesses moving away from there, right? And so you can be in other places. And so, like, you speak to people, oh, no, we're in Denver, Colorado, and, you know, we're in Miami.
We're in Austin, Texas.
And so do you see that trend continuing across the states where more tech businesses are, you know, in different parts of the country for different reasons?
Yeah, I definitely do. I mean, there's a lot of publicity last year about some of the large corporates moving out of California for tax and talent purposes. And thinking about the New Zealand context, there are about 30 New Zealand companies, tech and others around Denver, the Denver, Colorado Springs area. And, you know, that's a strategic choice. It's in the middle of the country, really easy access to East and West Coast. Costs are lower, cost of talent is slightly lower. cost of living. If anyone's interested, if anyone's at that point of considering where they might set up, online NZT has got a really great resource for where are the tech hubs in the United States, where might I actually base? And we've looked at 25 different cities that wouldn't be necessarily in your frame of reference. But, you know, San Francisco, gosh, so expensive. Price of talent, you know, you know who you're competing against. You're like, how would you stand out in that talent market? It's tough.
Yeah. What constitutes a New Zealand business these days?
One that is founded, has ownership in New Zealand.
Okay. Because, you know, speaking to a few people out there, I guess what happens is the child outgrows the parent, right? And since before you know it, you know, the CEO's American and, the founder might have been a Kiwi. There's a few stories like that I was sort of catching up on last week. But, mm-hmm. you know, you go, well, are they a Kiwi business? Well, I suppose the founder was. But, you know, that's always a tricky question to ask.
It is an interesting one. I mean, from an NZT perspective, because we're a government agency, we're charged with helping companies that are New Zealand-based businesses that return you know, profits and tax to New Zealand, but they will have, absolutely, if you look at zero, they'll have entities all around the world and they'll be paying taxes in those countries. But we look at what's the return to New Zealand.
Okay. If we just pause and think about the future at the moment, you know, what's the future hold? Now, one of the big things that came out of last week was if you want any sort of funding, any sort of tech business, there's no debate that AI needs to play a role in this, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So have NZT got any kind of strong views or opinions on that? Or is it a case of it's something we're going to watch and be aware of, but, you know, we won't have any sort of, we won't force the issue?
No, we haven't come out and taken a position on AI. What I will say, you know, you and I attended that same conference. What I will say is that it is table stakes. So it's no longer, you know, you say you have AI, and that's probably a little bit of a yawn because you should. Yeah. So what's different about your proposition? Yeah.
And I think for me, let's put that into context, was there was a term where, well, we have a sprinkling of AI. That was used quite a lot, you know, a few sessions. It's not like a sprinkling of salt or sprinkling of pepper. But what they're saying is that, you know, when they say that, people go, oh, yeah, we've got this amazing business. We're a tech business. Oh, by the way, we've got some AI, because it's the en vogue thing to say, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, what, and by the way, if anyone's listening to this, there's the SaaS napkin, so SaaS funding napkin, which is a thing. So if you just go and Google SaaS funding 2023 or SaaS funding napkin, and it's a VC that essentially produces it every year. But this is the first year. What they've done is, and they tell you about what you need to do at each stage. So whether you're pre-seed, seed, series A, series B, and kind of what the expectations around numbers, around product market fit, around team. But this is the first year they've actually added a complete section at the bottom, which is a clearly defined AI strategy is needed. So that's it now. It's non. And I think it was David Sachs, who was one of the Yammer founders and one of the VC's investors. He said exactly the same thing. You know, it's 85%. And those that probably aren't doing it, it's probably because it's a business that, you know, doesn't really need it. But, you know, the vast majority. So AI is definitely set to be on aware.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing I will say is that, you know, if people are sitting there going, how do I get AI into my business? Well, if you're a HubSpot user, HubSpot is investing a ton into AI. So it's not necessarily that you're behind, but think about your partners in the ecosystem you operate in and how they're leveraging AI, because that will obviously benefit you. It's not necessarily about you thinking up the next add-on to ChatGPT-4. It's about, you know, how am I being enabled? How is my team? Yeah. How are we being enabled?
Yeah, and I think the most obvious and the easiest one for any business that's maybe you know, looking to raise money is essentially is how you're going to use AI to interpret your data. You know, and I think that's the most obvious and easiest one. And, you know, most people, it will interpret data and trends, you know, way easier than someone would do. And it's interesting, even like in a HR world, right? You know, you can start, the AI can start seeing those trends even better than a human can. So I think that's the way you got to look at it, is certainly those big data tables you've got.
100%. I think a big data and as I said, I'd add to that enabling your sales team, right?
Yeah.
And a similar thing, right?
Yeah. Okay. So what else do businesses need to know? What's so great and amazing about taking on the US roof for Kiwi businesses?
You'd have heard this before, Lee, but I mean, the size of the prize is potentially enormous. So, you know, and there's a certain cachet, I believe, in saying, hey, we're in the US and we've got boots on the ground and we're making a go of it. So it's a really attractive market to be in. People are open to trying new things. If you've got a compelling proposition that's going to be, right for that particular ICP, not for everyone, just for that person, yeah. you know, you're going to go far. So, yeah, it's a buoyant market. The recession, of course, is here. It's in pockets. But right now in the Bay Area, again, despite probably what you hear, and yes, downtown is suffering at a 30% occupancy rate, but out in the valley, it's all systems go, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot happening.
Well, you saw that. There's cars still being sold, houses still being sold. So you wouldn't necessarily know there's a recession going on there, right?
No. Okay. No, not at all.
All right. So as we bring the interview to an end, I'm going to ask you a question that I think you already touched on this earlier, but I ask all my guests. So if you could go back and give 21-year-old Ruth some advice on life and what's going on in the world, what would that advice be?
Yeah, you gave me a heads up. So I've actually thought about this answer. So there are probably four things I'd say to Ruth. Dear Ruth, age 21. One, don't drink too much. No, I'm not kidding. but what I'd say, don't be so self-conscious. I think for me, I think a lot of people are the same, right? You're very much, particularly at that age, and unfortunately, as it hasn't gone away completely, Lee, very, very self-conscious. So drop that if you can. Remain curious and observant. I think it's a very hackneyed saying, but it's so true. You're given two ears and one mouth. Use them in equal proportion. So remain curious. This was a big one for me. Try things even if you think you're going to fail at them. I would avoid things if I didn't know I could succeed. And that, as a little segue, I was asked to try out for the US netball team. Now, when people stop laughing, but it was the US netball team. It was a national side. I was asked to try out, and I didn't because I thought, I'm never going to get on the team with these awesome Jamaican girls. So I didn't even try out. Really angry with 28-year-old Ruth that I didn't. And a bit like the two ears and one mouth thing, make sure you ask really good questions. No one, you don't need to know it all. Just think about the questions because it shows you're listening and engaging in content. And I think I'm amazed what people will divulge when you ask them questions. They'll tell you a lot. Yep. So
don't ask, don't get. That's what one always used to say.
No. Yep. And I think I could be a spy. I could be a spy, Lee. You just don't know.
A spy. Yeah, we might edit that bit out as well.
No, you can't. You can leave that in.
yeah. I'm sure that'd get picked up by some of our peers.
Probably.
Next 2 weeks for you, Ruth. What's going on in Ruth's land and world? What's your focus?
So I'm catching up with some more Kiwi companies who are in town, which is a real treat. They're at Dreamforce, the Salesforce conference. And then what am I doing? I'm not sure after that, Lee. It's back to more BAU, helping companies every day.
Yeah. Okay, cool. All right. So anyone listening to this thinking NZTE, I want to know more. I want to know how I want to take on the US and say take on all that advice, the good advice you've just given us in the last sort of 50 minutes or so, you know, how do they find out more?
Yeah, go to the website nzt.govt.nz. Sign up for, there's a whole section how to become a customer. So sign up there. There's a whole bunch of content that you can consume, some really good market guides, very tailored if you're in tech or food and beverage, good market guides giving you an overview of the US and other markets. Sign up there. If you want to talk to someone, send us an email. They'll give you a call back.
Fantastic. All right. Ruth, thanks so much for making the time to talk to me today. I'm sure all our listeners will be very intrigued and very interested in some of the topics we've talked about. So really appreciate it and wish you all the best in the next few weeks and next few years coming up.
Thanks, Lee. Good luck with your move. Can we talk about that? Good luck.
We'll talk about that in the next show.
Okay.
Cheers, Ruth.
Cheers.
So that's another great episode done and dusted. As always, I'd love to hear from you if you know anyone that's got a really good story to tell about how they are or not living a productive life. If you want to get in touch with me, please do so via my website, www.leestevens.co. That's www.leestevens.co. You can email me, lee@leestevens.co, or get in touch on LinkedIn, which is where I also hang out. In the meantime, have a good week.